This new paper on strong sustainability and what that means and what it means for New Zealand, and it's a pleasure for me to be able to welcome in the room here in Wellington today Wayne Cartwright, who is the Chair of Sustainability Aotearoa New Zealand, and also Jane Adams, who's on that board, and they are going to, in fact, go through and speak to you in the detail of what it means and what this book is really about, and what does the future hold for New Zealanders, and in fact, its place in the world. So, with that brief introduction, and also welcoming Brian Gould, the chair of the National Commission for UNESCO, who's also just joined us in the room, will make a start. And I believe, Wayne, you're going to start.
Yes, with. Did Brian wish to just wish to comment?
I was prepared to say a few words.
Yes, like. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
Please do.
Well, as you've no doubt heard, this, I think, very important document is the product of a collaboration between the New Zealand National Commission for UNESCO and SANS, and it has been produced as, I think, a quite major contribution to the UNESCO decade of education for sustainable development. We're about halfway through that decade, and I think this gives us an enormously powerful research tool in which to progress that kind of work. When you get a chance, as you may already have done, to look at this publication, I think you'll see that it takes us considerably further forward than perhaps where the debate has taken us so far. And the reason for that is that, as the title suggests, it identifies something called strong sustainability. And what I think is the characteristic of that is that it doesn't treat sustainability or concern for the environment as a sort of add-on extra. You carry on with your economy in the ordinary way, and then you tack on a concern for environmental or social issues or whatever, and you'll see a very telling critique of that approach in this publication. What it does is to locate everything we do, and that includes economic activity, within the context of the biosphere, that is a virtually self-contained context of life on this planet. And it rightly makes the point, I think, that without a biosphere that is functioning properly, nothing else can be done. If the biosphere is degrading and breaking down, then you can kiss economic activity goodbye. You can abandon the sorts of society as we know it. Now, these sound pretty apocalyptic statements, but that is, I think, what is being said here. And the technique that is used to demonstrate that is, I think, brilliantly done. That is, drawing and painting a scenario, inevitably fictional, but not, I think, fanciful. And what it does, based, I think, on very good science and expert knowledge, it shows how far we have to go if we're to move from our present state to one of strong sustainability. It shows that it's comprehensive and all-embracing and integrated. And so, as we sit here today and there is continuing discussion about emissions trading schemes and so on to deal with global warming, I'm not saying that mechanisms of that kind or carbon taxes or whatever are not important steps, but I think we have to acknowledge that global warming is a contributor to, but really a symbol of, a much wider degradation of the biosphere. And to believe that we can treat it in isolation, that we can just, we'll deal with that problem, but otherwise move on as we've done in the past, I think is completely to miss the point. A couple of minor points, perhaps. This is not a UNESCO document. It is very much SANS's document. We're delighted to have been a part of it. I think perhaps one or two minor qualifications. We might have wished to see perhaps more attention paid to potential Maori dimension, perhaps to cultural and social and ethnic aspects of that kind. I think Maori may have something to teach us about the relationship of humankind to the natural world. And perhaps just one concluding thought. I think it is necessarily the scenario painting, which, as I say, is done extremely well, is necessarily predicated on the notion that 2009 is a significant term for the way we treat our planet. I'd love to think that was true, and I think there are some of us who have had hopes in that direction, that the global economic crisis would prompt a complete reappraisal of how we approach these matters. But I think already we can see that powerful vested interests are fighting back very strongly. I think the future looks as though it may be one way for the time being, at any rate. Much carries on as before. And I think that simply demonstrates, and this document makes it abundantly clear, that it's relatively easy, although extremely valuable, to describe where we have to get to. It's not so easy to ensure that we get there. And that's now our task.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. My name is Wayne Cartwright, and we now have a presentation to make, myself and my colleague Jane Adams. I would also like to thank the National Commission of UNESCO for the support and for the partnership in this. The publication in front of you is a resource for education, both formal and to stimulate public debate. It appears to be relatively unique in that it stresses fully sustainable living and not just the mitigation of environmental damage, as Brian has already mentioned. Now, Jane and I have quite a lot of material to be covered fairly quickly, and it spans ecology and the environment, economics, underpinning ethics and values, and the politics of the required shift. So it is not tunnelled into any particular aspect of science. It covers the full gamut. I would like to recognise as well the presence here of Simon Hurtnon and of Jeroen ten Berg, who are responsible as the publishers of the booklet, which I'm sure some of you will want to see. So the contributors here, you can see from 100 people, about 100 people who are involved in workshops. Those 12 people there were the writers and the commentators of the piece of work. I had the honour myself of being the editor. Almost a referee, I guess. But that group spans across a broad range of fields of expertise. Now I'm going to pass the ball to Jane to go through the first part of the presentation.
Yes, thank you, Wayne. We'll start with looking at human existence and ecosystems, and really trying to emphasise the point that firstly we need to understand that ecosystems are everywhere. They are the interrelationships we have between living organisms, which include ourselves, and the air, soil and water systems. And ecosystems, including urban agricultural ecosystems, provide the services that sustain human life, our societies and our economies. So we are utterly dependent on these ecosystem services. Unfortunately, many ecosystems are being degraded by human activity, both within New Zealand and globally. The degradation of many New Zealand ecosystems is unsustainable. And in addition, globally, New Zealand has a high per capita contribution to potentially catastrophic degradation of the Earth's atmospheres and oceans, and even through our trading partners, the land-based ecosystems. The damaging impact of human activity on natural ecosystems is cumulative. And if these cumulative effects continue beyond certain critical points, recovery often becomes quite impossible. And the ecosystem services, that's these services on which our lives depend, may be lost permanently. So if this is allowed to happen, human society, as we know, will disintegrate because the ecosystem services are no longer available. And currently, the future, we don't know where the future is, 10, 20, 30, 50 years when we start to really see the impacts, but this future is our future, and it's a dismal prospect. So what is the true meaning of being sustainable? Currently, we're doing a lot of good things for the environment, but this is not enough to be sustainable. The environmental actions we're currently taking are very laudable, but they're not enough. We mustn't think that steps to mitigate climate change will make New Zealand sustainable. Much, much more is going to be required. Sustaining the ecosystems on which we depend requires a systemic approach to change that goes far beyond limiting emissions, controlling effluents, or managing solid waste. Thanks. We explore the weaknesses of New Zealand's current environmental policies and practices. Currently, most New Zealand environmental policy and practice is based on what we would call the triple bottom line, sometimes the quadruple bottom line reporting model of what we would call weak sustainability. This model allows the causes of unsustainability, the root causes, to remain in place even while we're still doing quite good things for the environment. And this is dangerously inadequate because it deals with the symptoms of unsustainability but not its root causes.
Good, thank you, Jane. As we went through this piece of work, through the think tanks and then the subsequent writing, we first of all diagnosed the current difficulties, and Jane has just been through the science of that, if you will. We then looked further at the reasons and the principles underlying these reasons, and found with considerable strength that the root cause of unsustainability here in New Zealand and internationally is the approach taken to economics. This and the scientific outcomes of it, and the ethical and values, or the ethical and values positions that underpin economics, these are the causes of the problem. Now, at present, our society attaches overwhelming importance to economic outcomes and the social well-being that is assumed to arise from them. And this is part and parcel of our everyday life. This is the way we are. Environmental outcomes are accorded much less attention, and even this is pretty grudging. Now, the next diagram illustrates this point. Here is a triple bottom line model in the way that it actually is, and it's been called by some humorists the Mickey Mouse version of the triple bottom line. Some people have called it a pig. Whichever way you look at it, though, it's not a joke. This is the truth. And we have economic activity going on, which is continually undermining the ecosystems, degrading the ecosystems that Jane has referred to. We do some environmental things, but we do not address the root cause. This is what we call the business as usual, the BAU model, and it's where we are as a human civilization, globally and here in New Zealand. So this approach to economics is actually based on a delusion. And that's a strong word, but that is definitely the way that we see it. So the ranking of outcomes, economic outcomes over ecosystem outcomes, is a delusion because the Earth actually works in the reverse way. It's the reverse of the way that the Earth works. The economy actually operates as a part of the ecological systems of Earth. And as a result of this, mainstream economic beliefs and practices that we all engage in have put humanity on a collision course with nature. The diagram that comes up next, which we call the strong sustainability model, illustrates the way things actually are. We have a biosphere, which is the Earth and all its ecosystems, in the atmosphere, in the crust of the Earth, and everything on the Earth. Within that, we have what we call a sociosphere, which is where the humans come into it, and human beings, through their social organisation and practice, are a part of the biosphere. And within that, humans do stuff that we call economics, that we call the economy. And that is simply a part of what humans do. So economics and the economy is not separate to, it is within the ecological structure of the Earth, of the biosphere. And that is the point that human beings have disastrously overlooked until now. Many people have been making this point, we're making it again. Now, why is our current approach to economics, why does it cause unsustainability? There are four reasons that I want to go over with you. First of all, there is an assumption that economic growth can continue indefinitely. That is false. That is false because it's actually impossible. The biosphere, the ecological systems of the biosphere, have finite limits. That is simply the science of it. We can't do anything about it, yet we assume that that matter does not hold. And when those limits are reached, as Jane has pointed out, continued economic growth causes cumulative and accelerating degradation. So perpetual economic growth, contrary to the prevailing view in society that it is intrinsically good, even essential, is in fact false. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that most of the ecological systems that Jane has told us about, involving the air, the oceans, lakes and waterways, involving the climate, the clean-up processes that occur naturally, taking up a lot of the waste from human activity, most of these are in what we call the commons. They are not in private ownership, they are not in corporate ownership, they are simply there and not in any sort of ownership at all. Our economic practice, our economic theory and practice suggests that all useful things are done through markets. Well, it turns out that market mechanisms overlook that which is in the commons totally. And so our markets offer no guidance for the utilisation and maintenance of these essential ecological services. By the way, these ecological services have been estimated to contribute to human beings more than the aggregate of the GDP of all the nations on Earth. So what these systems do for us is greater in dollar terms than what we do for ourselves. So to overlook them is just madness. And so these ecological systems and the services they provide are misused by an economic system that's simply blind. And this flaw in economics threatens the survival of human society. And not only threatens it, that's the path we're on. The third reason, and it's related to the previous one, mainstream economics assumes that humans are separate from nature and are therefore free to exploit it. And indeed, this notion goes right back, I believe, even though I'm not a biblical scholar, right back into some aspects of the scriptures of the Old Testament. So it seems to be well-founded, but it's nonsense. Because actually, all people and their society, and our society, we're all a part of nature. So to see ourselves as separate from nature and therefore free to exploit it just is simply wrong. And so through exploiting nature and degrading its ecosystems, people are exploiting themselves and diminishing their own quality of life. And the fourth reason, and this one goes right back to the doctrines that Adam Smith became famous for, although interestingly he didn't emphasise this greatly at the time that he did his writing. Those who have enlarged upon his work are actually the culprits for this. But mainstream economics is based on the concept of self-serving human activity. Individualistic behaviour is assumed and expected, the idea of rational economic man, or woman. The idea that that concept will bring best outcomes for individuals and for society as a whole is deeply rooted in our economy and in all of our commerce and in the political and legal structures that underpin it. Actually, the reverse is true. Self-serving individualistic behaviour is not a characteristic of ecosystems. Human beings have to recognise that they are a part of these ecosystems and act in the knowledge that they are interdependent, not only with each other, but also with the other aspects of the ecosystems in which they are embedded. Jane?
Yes, so exploring then, what does this actually mean if we're going to undertake strong sustainability? What does this mean in terms of the way a society might operate? And we can see that strong sustainability is really going to require, first and foremost, a major shift in our ethics and our values. Firstly, we have to say that a strongly sustainable human society will need to live and develop as part of the Earth's ecosystems, the point that we've really been making over the previous few slides. We acknowledge that obviously human activity is going to influence and maybe change these ecosystems to quite some extent, but to be strongly sustainable, humans can do nothing that will upset the stability or reduce the diversity or resilience of these ecosystems. All complex systems are adaptable and changeable, but all complex systems can get to a point where they become unstable and can change quite unpredictably, and that's what we need to try and just avoid in the future. So we've called these needed changes to our ethics and values strong sustainability, and we do so to distinguish them from what we currently have, which we call weak sustainability, the triple bottom line model, where society and the environment are seen to be adjunct to the economy and not the economy contained within them. So this also means, in terms of changing our ethics and values, that we're going to need to look very carefully between what we value. And I think the perceived linkages between success and economic growth will need to be severed. Non-material sources of happiness will start to have much greater importance in a strongly sustainable society. The deep interdependence of all people will be affirmed, along with robust community values. And nature will be valued through citizens knowing that their society and its political economy is an integral and interdependent component of natural systems and the biosphere. So what are some of the enabling conditions for a strongly sustainable New Zealand society? So if we acknowledge that we're going to need to see quite a shift in our ethics and values, we need also to have some actions and enabling conditions to see us moving to a strongly sustainable future. So in addition to the core shift in ethics and values, strongly sustainable New Zealand will need to limit emissions into the atmosphere, discharges into waterways and the oceans, and chemicals into soils, so that they are retained within the assimilative capacities of the relevant ecosystems, which means that the ecosystems can absorb and regenerate and renew the quality of the water and the air and the soils. Second series of enabling conditions for a strongly sustainable New Zealand society will be that we need to regenerate and grow natural and social capital to sustain the health and resilience of the people and the whole of nature. The focus on human equity, human health and well-being will become far more important, as well as our natural ecosystems, ensuring the health and resilience of those. We'll need to look to substitute renewable resources for non-renewable resources wherever feasible, and start to conserve non-renewable material resources within closed cycles. We will also need to ensure that our citizens are broadly and deeply eco-literate. Through education, citizens will start to know and understand that they are actually part of natural ecosystems. Strong sustainability will become deeply embedded in all of New Zealand's governance, economic, legal and educational systems and their applications. Brian.
Thanks, Jane. And the last two of the enabling conditions have to do with the economy or economics. So we will need a new approach to economics that maximises the community well-being within the requirement for ecological integrity. Some people listening here or reading this may say, well, what the devil does that really mean? Well, there's been quite a lot of thought given to this already within certain branches of economics and in the political spectrum as well, but it has received almost no attention so far. I refer here to the economics of steady state economics. And that's within an academic field called ecological economics. I make this point because it's about time for that thinking to enjoy its place in the sun. Community well-being prevails over individual well-being within this model. It must do, because communities are better aligned with ecological systems. And of course, everything happens within the requirements for ecological integrity. The second point made on this page is that there's some interesting consequences of this for international trade policy. We will import in a sustainable state only from countries and regions that have produced goods according to strongly sustainable criteria. There is no point in New Zealand being strongly sustainable if it then tries to import it, if you like, unsustainability from other countries. Now, what Jane and I have been over now is what in our publication we refer to as the principles of strong sustainability. That is about the first third of the publication. The following two-thirds of it consist of a scenario or a set of scenarios which explore the question, what would it be like? What would it be like to become sustainable in New Zealand? And the first little part refers to the transition, and the second part of the scenario is a picture of what it could be like to be in a strongly sustainable New Zealand. We should be careful here to point out, as we do in the publication, that it's partially strong sustainability. If the rest of the world is not also strongly sustainable, we can only do our best. Now, within the transition here, we've painted some pictures of what would need to be done, and I now emphasise that the scenarios here that we have are strongly optimistic. These are scenarios of a transition that actually works. The scenarios, and that depends, it working depends on making strong decisions, difficult decisions, at the right time, and some of them are in the quite near term. If we miss those decisions, if we miss the timing, then the scenarios that we paint here will be implausible. And while there is considerable hardship, even chaos, in the scenarios that we paint here, these are the most optimistic ones that we think exist. And the scenario of missing the deadlines, making mistakes, are frankly quite horrific. And we've worked on those, but would not think of publishing them. It would scare the horses too much. Now we come to the point of, well, how can the shift be made? Well, many citizens right now will be resistant to the need to shift. We recognise that. The need for it has to be much more apparent than it is today. So what we're doing with this publication is providing an early warning, if you like, some early awareness, so that those who wish to start thinking about this can do so ahead of time of the majority of the public. But some things are going to happen which will bring this to the attention of the public, not only in New Zealand but globally, with considerable force. These understandings will be accelerated by the now inevitable, abrupt and radical shifts in human living, work and recreation that will be caused by processes of global change that have already begun. And the next page just mentions this. We could go into it in great more detail and will at some other time. It's certainly in the publication that we've got happening combinations of environmental degradation, climate change, hydrocarbon price escalation to huge levels, structural economic failures and dislocations arising largely from what I've mentioned before, water scarcity, food supply deficits. And this will take global human civilization anyway far outside the range of any prior experience that we've had. Now, this is going to happen. It's simply a matter of when and how vigorous these changes will be. But they are going to happen whether we follow a path of strong sustainability or not. So the current situation as we know it, the current way of living, cannot and will not continue anyway. Major change is inevitable, and most of that change will be the result of unsustainable human practice of the past and present. Our challenge as a people is how we will anticipate and respond to that. And we, as the preparers of this publication, steadfastly hope that that will be with hope and resilience and a positive perspective rather than doom and gloom. The changes that are coming will have profound and deeply troubling impacts in New Zealand, but probably less in New Zealand than in some other parts of the world, which is an interesting perspective. Civil society, by and large, will recognise with increasing strength that the institutions and practices of the economy and governance are not coping with the impacts of change and are becoming dysfunctional. Our scenario says that the way in which we govern ourselves, our economic institutions, will become increasingly dysfunctional. And at some point there will be the right time for civil society to determine that substantial changes have to be made. That is not now, it's probably not far away. Just some comments about motivation and leadership of this process. The shift will require very strong leaders, and they will need to emerge, and they'll need to possess appropriate skills. They'll need to be broadly based across a number of areas of experience, and they'll have to be adept at managing change. And this is, I believe, is one of our most telling points. Incumbent political and corporate leaders who are committed to the current and failing paradigms of economics and governance will be unlikely to have the required skills and motivation to be these leaders. And indeed, many of them are likely to try to hang on to the past, and so they will oppose the needed shift. That will create considerable tensions in our communities and our society. In other words, few of our current leaders will be suitable for the required shift. Our analysis shows that it is possible for New Zealand to shift from its current unsustainable path, but that is also possible globally. The period available for making a start on this is very short. The longer we delay the needed changes, the greater hardship there is that lies in New Zealand's future. And if the delay is too long, the shift will become impossible. And human society as we know it here and elsewhere will simply decline substantially.
Could I ask a question?
Yep, two more pages to go.
Yeah. And then we'll launch into the Q&A.
Yep. I just want to say now that the report, the publication, has been published today. Here it is. The details are there for you. And we would commend that to you. And finally, in closing, I would like to thank you, emphasising the root cause of unsustainability is our approach to economics. The assumption that economic growth can continue indefinitely is false. Of course, it will continue in pockets, but there will be decline in other areas. Our values and ethics must change. Without that change, economics won't. Mitigation and adaptation, what we're into at the moment, will simply not be enough. It's a good thing, but not enough. And we give our website there where you can obtain an online PDF version of the publication. Thank you.